So welcome everybody to this morning's brainwashing session. And I don't know, it feels to me the last day or two we're getting a little bit philosophical. We're talking about non-self and talking about the stages of enlightenment. So that's one way to look at enlightenment. It's one way to look at what you're doing here. And especially many people, because of our education, we love being philosophical. But we should always remember our feelings, our emotions as well. And today I wanted to do the more feely-feely talk on meditation, especially the importance of happiness and bliss in the meditation path, and also on the path towards enlightenment as well. It's not just about thinking things out and getting answers, because as you know already, what thinking does to you, it can drive you crazy. And it can just give you headaches, and it just goes round in circles, never really gets anywhere. But the emotional, the feeling is something very important. And I noticed that a long time ago, as a senior monk, and regarded by some as like one of the leaders of Buddhism here in Australia, that sometimes you have to address ethical dilemmas in our society. You know, things like yesterday, homosexuality, you know, things like euthanasia, things like abortion, things, all these important issues which we have to discuss. And obviously that people look to someone like me, not just to be silent and just to not get involved, but actually to give some leadership. And one of the things which has always driven me for a long time now is that when you have some of these decisions, it's very easy to think about them, to argue about them and use logic. But it's also to look at the emotional feeling behind your ideas and views. Because a lot of times there's things which just feel right, or things which you just know are wrong. And you can't really at first put your finger on why that is. And to me, especially in ethics, in virtue, I really trust that feeling, even more than some of the arguments which I come up with afterwards. Because there's some things which you know are just wrong. You see it, you feel it, there's something wrong in this. And there's some things that say, what's the problem? It's beautiful, it's wonderful. And that emotional part is something that needs to be also recognized in your practice of virtue, in the practice of meditation, and even in the practice of wisdom. It's not just an intellectual path, it's also an emotional growth as well. And so I tell lots of people that you must always follow your gut feeling, except if you've got chronic indigestion. Other than that, think about it in here. Unless you've got, what is that, irritable bowel syndrome. Yeah, then just forget about that. Because a lot of time that gives you a lot of direction, not just in ethics, but also in Dhamma and also in meditation. I mentioned even yesterday that when we're talking about the different sects in Buddhism, you know, the Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, yeah, sometimes you're supposed to be different. People said that you're not the same. And, you know, that's what I was taught. But then you see sort of a Tibetan monk, a Mahayana monk, a nun or whatever. That's not what it feels like in here. It feels like in here these are your brothers, these are your friends. So, and I trust that more. And what happens next, once you start to trust, you know, the sense of goodness and purity and beauty and loveliness inside your heart, then when you go and look at those teachings, whether it's the teachings of the Vinaya or the rules for the monks and the nuns or the teaching of the Dhamma, then you know it really makes sense. Then actually you can see the arguments. Yeah, there is an argument there that Buddhism is basically a very compassionate, soft, non-vindictive, non-judgmental, non-punishing path. And why do you actually see that? Because you know it's in here. Does it really make sense to punish people? Does it really, really make sense to you to get angry? Yeah, you do that. But what does it do to you? What does it do to the other person? What does it do to the society and the world? Does it really help? When you get lost in thinking, yeah, you can have all the justifications for getting angry. All the reasons why that person needs to be punished, to teach them a lesson. But if you follow what's in here, it makes no sense at all. And when you start follow the beautiful Buddha's teachings, he said he did follow that heart. And from that heart it really worked. Look at the state of our world now, the state of our societies. So much punishment, so much anger, so much vindictiveness. Does that work? Just have to look down the road there, the prison we have just down the road. And I don't know if you noticed, those men in green, they come and work here. At the last retreat, one of the retreats we had here, that was last October for the Buddhist Fellowship. You know, the cook, Bianca couldn't come, she was busy. So the person who cooked was one of the prisoners from up the road. He volunteered his time to actually do all the cooking for all the meditators during that retreat. And my goodness, he was a good cook. And I mean, with all respect to Bianca, is she here? No, she's cooking. But this guy, I couldn't believe just what he cooked. I went in there today to see Suwadi, and Bianca was getting some pizzas or something to put in the oven. This guy made his own pizzas and curries and goodness knows what else. I couldn't believe just what this one man prepared in just one morning. You know, even making the dough himself for the pizza. Incredible. And he just got so much fun out of that, and he put so much love in it, and he was a prisoner up the road. Now, I don't think he would mind me telling you, a sex offender. Now, many years ago, he made a big mistake. But, you see that, and all the people who saw that think, this is just a really nice guy, really helping out. So why do we punish people? To me, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So the beautiful part of Buddhism, it felt good in the heart, like many people. If I'd have told you before that that was a prisoner, a man would say, oh my God, you know, what's he going to do? You'd have locked your doors. You'd have put guards on the doors. But no, he's a really nice person. So this actually is telling us something. It feels right that we should forgive. It feels beautiful that we should love each other and just no punishment. And you know that feels good. So when you trust your heart, then you understand where some of these ethical teachings come from. And when people ask me, is it good or is it bad? That's where I go to first of all. I don't go to five precepts of Vinaya Pitaka or some philosophical doctrine. I go to here first of all. You can feel it. And I trust that. And then afterwards I go and look at the books to check it out. And of course, the Buddha felt the same. The Buddha was a very beautiful, kind, compassionate, forgiving being. And he knew that wasn't just being soft. He knew that that was going to work. And my goodness, it did work. Nothing else works in our society. But that does, compassion and forgiveness and love and just respecting people and letting the past go. So that feels good. So now you apply that beautiful feeling, which is accompanied by happiness. Punishment. What does it feel like when you want to punish somebody? Or when you actually inflict that punishment? What does it feel like when you're angry at someone? What does it feel like when you can't let things go? You know that that's not happiness. That's not the path of peace and joy. That's the path of misery, depression. Because you know what that feels like. That is suffering. And the Buddha said, we're not going to follow that path. We're going to follow the path of the end of suffering. So if ever you have an ethical conflict inside you, don't think about it, feel it. And follow the path of happiness. Now that path of happiness is not indulgence. Because even indulgence, you know, just getting it for me, you know, the last piece of toast, just the last, you know, last hot cross bun. Actually, where's Tom? Did I have the last hot cross bun today? Whew. So, doing it for yourself, it doesn't work. You don't feel good afterwards. But sharing it with others, that actually feels good. That is joy. That is happiness. And you find you cannot be selfish and have happiness at the same time. If you actually, you may sort of try and convince yourself, yeah, I deserve it, yeah, it's a dog-eat-dog world, yeah, everyone's in it for themselves, I'm going to just take mine and that's it. Really, if you've got even a small bit of mindfulness, even a smidgen of wisdom, you know that that doesn't work, that feels terrible, that hurts, that is suffering. But if you manage to have enough mindfulness, enough wise perception, you'll know that the happy path is sharing and giving. That's why, you know, it's against my rules for me to open the door for you when you go out from this hall. But you see me many times rushing to that door and opening to you. Why? Because that feels fun. It actually feels good in here. That really feels that that's the right thing to do. And of course, you get fun too. So a lot of my ethics, that's only a small little etiquette sort of type of rule, but it feels so good. That's right. That is obviously compassionate, kind. That is on the path. That brings me joy and it brings you joy. Even the three sadhus in the morning, the sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I'm the only monk who does that. I don't think you've seen anyone else do that. But why do you do that? Because you know, it creates a lot of happiness. It feels good. That's not indulgent happiness. That's just like almost like joy of playfulness. Does that feel good? Of course it does. So you follow the heart. Other monks say, no, monks aren't supposed to do that. Monks are supposed to be serious. They're supposed to be enlightened. I really thought, because I think I went to Zen monks, Sri Lankan monks, and Burmese monks in the early years when I started becoming a Buddhist, and they would never smile. Especially, I remember this Burmese monk I went to see, he's a very famous monk, for those of you who know, Thongpul U Sayadaw, a long time ago, I went to see him. His mouth never moved. It was totally horizontal. You know, you try to upset him, and it was the same. You try and crack a joke, it was the same. Totally horizontal, because that's what they're supposed to do. It reminded me of like an alien or like some robot, some sort of cyborg which, you know, somebody in California had built. Just, I will not laugh, I will always be even-minded, I will not get angry. It wasn't human. And it was such a joy actually to see monks like Ajahn Chah and other sort of monks. Eventually, I mean, the Burmese laugh now. The first monk which I saw was laughing was a very Unyanika. He's a beautiful monk who came to Perth some time ago. Unfortunately, he died when he was quite sort of, young, but not old. So he's a very beautiful monk. You know, he's laughing and smiling and gave a lot of joy. And now, of course, Sri Lankan monks do that. We all do that. But I told that story. I went to Hong Kong in February. And, you know, I gave a retreat like I do now, crack a few jokes, do over-the-top sadhus, and got people sort of happy and gotten some nice meditation as well. But I can never remember this nun who came to say goodbye to me. She said, oh, thank you, thank you. She was a Mahayana nun, a Chinese Mahayana nun. Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you for coming to our temple. Now I can smile. Because she tried to smile before and people told her, no, a nun is not supposed to smile. And she felt so terrible about that. She had to restrain her natural impulse to feel happy. And when I sort of was there for 8 or 9 days, and people were smiling, and they felt good about it, I opened the doors for her to smile. I said, thank you so much for coming. It's a small thing, but I appreciate that. So you may look in the books, is it right to smile, is it not right to smile? But what does it feel like in here? And you know it's right. And it feels happy. The Buddha made two distinctions here, the pleasures of the world and the pleasures of the Dharma. One he called Amisa Sukha, if you want another Pali word. Those are the pleasures of, you know, pigging out on the food. You know, the pleasures of, you know, just listening to music or seeing a great movie, or the pleasures of sex, or the pleasures of, you know, the worldly stuff. But there's also the pleasures of Dharma. You know, inspiration is one of them. So if you hear a good talk, let yourself get inspired. Let yourself get uplifted. If you see a really kind, compassionate act, let yourself smile. Bring up that happiness. Whenever you reflect on the generosity of people, like all of you sitting on this side of the hall here, that floor which you're sitting on was laid by the monks till about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the day before this place opened. No, that was Santuti was one of them. Working just, I don't know, they started early in the morning and they kept on going and going and going. About 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning they finished. Just so you can sit and meditate. It's usually the case in Thailand, the lay people serve the monks. In Sri Lanka, you know, you don't let the monks do anything. You do it all for them. But here, the monks do it for you. And we get so much fun out of that. And you get fun too. You get inspired by what's happening. And that inspiration, that gives you a joy. Can you please write an essay about inspiration? You can't put it into words, can you? You feel it. And you feel the great joy and inspiration of people coming to feed you, Bianca doing all the cooking for you, Mike and Daniel looking after the place. If there's any water not working, I'll go and fix it up or get someone to fix it up. All the gardeners, prisoners who were moving the mulch the other day, you know, the monks who come and look after and serve, the nuns who come and help. Everybody, it just gives you so much inspiration and joy. Get off on it. Indulge to the max. Really get into that joy of inspiration. It's one of the reasons why the Buddha gave some preliminary meditations. For those of you it hasn't worked yet and you're trying so hard, try this method of meditation. Buddhanusati, Dhammanusati, Sanghanusati, Jaganusati, Siranusati, Dewanusati. Oh yeah! What are those? The recollection of the Buddha. Not statues, but the qualities. For those of you who have read or sort of got some idea of what this guy really was and what he did, you reflect. Or if you've been to like the holy places in India where the Buddha lived, now the Vulture's Peak, this wasn't some guy who lived in a palace. He lived in a cave on the top of a mountain. You can go there now. And the most inspiring thing about the Vulture's Peak is no one has developed it. It's not some big cathedral with chandeliers and gold and paintings by, what was his name? Michelangelo. It's simple. Just like in the time of the Buddha. Sometimes I think, what would Jesus do if he went into the Vatican? He just gets so upset. Look, this is not what we're supposed to. We're supposed to be simple people. Not sort of have elaborate things. We're religion. We're not sort of lords and ladies and kings and queens. But, on the Vulture's Peak, it's so simple. And it just reminds me of just how this great person lived. And the best thing, you can go and sit in those caves and no one stops you. You can see it where the Buddha sat. And you know that your bum is on the same place the Buddha's bottom was on. Now that really gets to me when I do that. And I actually start thinking about it. I dwell upon that. And oh my goodness gracious. The mind just flies and gets into incredibly powerful meditations. And even though I'm a long way away from sort of the Vulture's Peak in Rajagaha, I've been up there several times and I can close my eyes and remember it. I remember that beautiful place. I can visualize it. It's right in my head right now. And already you sort of see the tingling in the back of your head. The inspiration is coming up. The joy, the emotions you're starting to generate. You can find out whatever really turns you on with the Buddha. Whatever inspires, uplifts, moves you. Not to thinking, but to feeling. And develop that beautiful inspiration which comes up inside of you. All right, with the Dhamma. You know, some of these teachings have saved your life, literally. You know, you've been in a real big mess sometimes and just remember something, you know, which, you know, don't say it came from me. I said, I've been brainwashed by Ajahn Chah. It comes from the Buddha. It's nothing to do with any teacher. It's Dhamma. It doesn't belong to anybody. It's not Ajahn Brahm's teachings. It's not even the Buddha's teachings. It's Dhamma. It's truth. No one owns it. And sometimes you hear something, it doesn't matter who said it, and it really is important for you. Sometimes it's something which just changes just the whole way you look at life and just problems just vanish from you. Oh, just what bliss. And when you sort of think of that, beautiful teachings of freedom and forgiveness. Many of you have probably had so much guilt and depression, feeling how bad you've been. And someone comes along and says, you're okay. You're good enough. And you believe that and people actually accept you. They really do, with no criticism, with no fear of being punished or saying something or doing something which will offend. Oh, that really moves you. That's the Dhamma teaching you. And isn't that beautiful, Dhamma? To know that somewhere, someplace, there's someone who will accept you 100% who you are. You don't have to pretend. You don't have to try and be different. And best of all, you don't have to be perfect. All these years I try to be perfect. ever since, you know, your father told you off for something you did wrong, and sometimes I didn't know what I did wrong, but it was something wrong. I didn't really understand, I was just being a kid. And you're trying so hard to please these people you loved. And then later on in life, you try to please your teachers, and try to please your friends, and try to please your partner in life, and try to please everybody else, and even try to please yourself. And now at last, you know you don't have to do that. You're already pleasing. Pleasing to all beings. That's the Dhamma. So when you do that, those teachings, they just, wow. Why didn't I hear this when I was 2 years of age? And then it just makes you so happy. And that inspiration, that's what I'm talking about. You feel it. That is good. That is Dhamma. That is right. That is truth. You don't care where it comes from, what it's called, Buddhism, Islam or whatever. I don't care. It's truth. You feel it in here. You don't give it a name. Oh, the Sangha Anusati. I don't know about you, but there's a few monks who've really, really helped me. Even my first meditation teacher, he wasn't a monk. But you know, the sort of meditation he taught me, he got me going, got me started. And if I saw him today, I don't know if he's still alive, if I saw him today and he came in here, I'd jump off my seat and I'd just grab him by the feet and kiss his feet, slobber all over him. Even that's against the rules. I'm a monk, I'm not supposed to do that. And it's probably bad for my health too, but who cares? It's inspiration. I remember somebody actually did that to me once. It was this monk Santikaro. He was a teacher in Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery, the Western monk there. And I was just in Bangkok sometimes. He said, "You're Ajahn Brown." He said, "Yeah." And he came and just grabbed my feet and bowed his head to them. I said, "What the heck are you doing?" And he said, "Don't you remember?" I said, "Of course I don't." When he was a Peace Corps worker, he came to visit Wat Nanacha. I was still a young monk, but I taught him meditation. I was his first meditation teacher. He said, "That meant so much to me in my life." Now, you don't realize, you may be just another Westerner coming through the monastery. But that changed my whole existence. I just come to say thank you. And you have this incredible gratitude. I mean, really deep gratitude. So you just bow. And just please let me bow. Just forget about your feet. Just let me bow. And you feel that. And it's so inspiring. You feel so good. That's the inspiration of the Sangha. The teachers, these great people, men, women, whoever it was, who really turned you on to this incredibly powerful path. Just, oh, what joy. Ahosukang. You get into that. Now, the nice thing is when you do those types of, well, the other ones, Chaganasati, is all your generosity. Oh, I don't do very much. To hell you don't. You're all doing a huge amount of generosity. And whenever you do that, wow, this is an incredibly powerful thing. You know, many of you, whether you just pulled out a weed in the garden or you gave sort of $100,000 for this place, so many of you have contributed to this Jhana Grove. It's your place. It's not Buddhist society. It's Buddhist society is just a name. It belongs to all the people. All the people who've ever sort of come here, the people here now, the people in the future, it belongs to everybody. Even the people who never come here, but still send a dollar here and a dollar there. What an amazing thing this is to build a facility, which is not money-making, it's not a business. We don't sell little knick-knacks. We haven't got a souvenir shop outside. It's a totally pure Buddhist meditation. It's just for the sake of giving people the opportunity to meditate. Like even recently, as Jeff is over there, a few people said that that big golf cart was a bit too hard for an elderly or sick person to manoeuvre. So someone just suggested, why don't we get a little small little cart for the disabled? We just mentioned it, we're just talking about it. Yeah, that's a good idea. And Jeff over there goes and tells his mate Ollie, who's he's a Christian, a Catholic. He said, I can find one for you. And he just sends one over here. So even the Catholics, the Christians, the Muslims, everybody, they also help. Isn't that beautiful that we help each other? So that little cart over there came from Ollie Pickett. He's a Christian brother, that's right. Isn't that beautiful? It inspires you. So all that inspiration of dana, of giving, is one of the beautiful aspects of a human being. They don't think for themselves. They think for the community, for us. And they're willing to sacrifice, even though it hurts, for the sake of others. Dana. That is one of the reasons, you know, why people feed us so much here. It's the reason why I put on weight. It's nothing to do with me, it's just the beauty of Dana. Because that's the reason why all these people come many days to feed you. It's joy of giving. And it really is joy. If you haven't done it yourself, try it. Just bring some food or something to the nuns' monastery at Dharamsala. And you say, ah, oh, they've already got enough. Yeah, they've got more than enough to feed 100 nuns there. That's not the point. You go there and you just feel so much happiness and so much joy. I had to learn that as a young monk. Remember this story? I haven't told it for a long time. When you go, first of all, to Wat Pa Phong, Wat Nanachai hadn't been built yet, Ajahn Chah's monastery, you go on alms round in the morning, every morning, just at dawn, with your bowl, and go to the village for rice and come back again. And because you're walking with no shoes in the dirt, you know, before you go in the hall, you have to have a foot bath, you know, just to wash your feet and dry them afterwards. So we do that, splash around in the tub and just dry your feet and then do your bowl. But when Ajahn Chah would come back, he would never wash his own feet. As soon as he came in, about 7 or 8, maybe 10 monks would rush up, grab hold of his feet and wash them. And now, being a Westerner, I thought, that's not right. You know, having people wash your feet. You know, he's old enough to wash his own feet. And anyway, I mean, look, 8, 9, 10 people. I mean, that's too much. Maybe, you know, Westerners have a roster. Okay, you do it today, and then after you. And that makes sense, doesn't it? What's the point of having so many people, you know, to wash, and only little feet? But it was so weird, and I was playful, I was curious. And so one day I decided I'm going to try that to find out what it's all about. And you had to be very quick, because actually there was a race there. So I saw it, I was prepared, I was waiting, I determined to do this. So I was really on the lookout. And as soon as I saw him coming, I timed it, got up quickly, raced. And you know, I was fast enough to get a whole toe all by myself. I actually got a toe. And I washed it and washed it. It was so ridiculous, illogical, crazy, you know, for a theoretical physicist from Cambridge to get off on washing one toe of this old Thai monk. But then I understood what this Dana business is all about. It doesn't make sense. But my good, it's fun. My God, it's fun. You really enjoy it. So, not logic, not thinking, but emotional. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It's inspiring. And now that starts to uplift your meditation. That's Jaganasati, that's Siranasati, all the beautiful precepts you're keeping. You're really good people. Oh, and you know this, how often it is that people come here and they, what was it Daniel was saying? The window cleaner came here. Now, the first time we got a professional window cleaner, because every once a year we decided a long time ago to give a professional clean to the place. The rest of the time, people actually, just with their love, they clean the place. But we thought we'd try once a year to get professional cleaners in. So we got the professional window cleaner in. And so this guy, he was working how many days? 2 days or 3 days? Yeah, 4 days. So he stayed over here. And he wrote this email back, which sold to Dana, which Daniel showed me. And what did it actually say? It was something like, yeah, so much bliss and happiness after spending a few days here. That's what the window cleaner said. And he was just a window cleaner. And just, you know, seeing the beautiful, virtuous place here and the good people, that inspired him. And sometimes we underestimate just, you know, you're keeping 8 precepts, 5 precepts, whatever you're keeping. Just how beautiful that virtue is in a world where we celebrate cheats and we sort of put murderers and wars and other stuff on the front page of our newspapers. There are virtuous people, and you're them, and you inspire others. Isn't that really wonderful? You're actually doing something for the world. You're changing the world. Showing the beauty of virtue. So even window cleaners, Aussie window cleaners come here, no idea what Buddhism is. So, you know, that sign on the front there, trespassers will be converted. It's true. So those are the inspirations. And that's a form of joy and happiness, which has nothing to do with the world. It's not indulgent happiness, but that really feels good. It feels pleasurable, and you really get into that. So this is what we focus on, we develop, we indulge in. It's just like you've got sort of a beautiful, I don't know, a mango or a banana or something, or a piece of cake, and it's especially delicious. You don't put it in your mouth and swallow it straight away. You savour it. Mmm. Oh, that banana is just so sweet. Mmm, I'm not going to swallow it that quickly. I'm going to suck all the juice out of this before I swallow it. That's what you should do with the inspirational pleasures. Don't do that with bananas, but do that with inspirational pleasures. You know, such as remembering the Buddha, the Dharma, the beautiful teachers, the great places, the beautiful generosity of people, they're just the greatness of virtue. Oh, this is just so wonderful. Now, you're developing happiness. You may notice that each one of those happinesses, I call them the happiness of letting go. Of selflessness. It's nothing to do with me. It's nothing to do with attaining things or getting things. It's all to do with this beautiful letting go and disappearing. That's why they are unworldly happinesses. The happiness of winning the lotto. The happiness of your team winning the football match. The happiness of, you know, you buying your new home or getting married or whatever. That's the happiness of attaining things. This is the happiness of letting go, and that's what we're inspiring ourselves with. Whenever you know that type of meditation, you can do that at the beginning of your meditation. Spend 5 or 10 minutes of remembering the inspirational parts of your life, feeling it in your guts. You may need to keep repeating it to yourself with words just to get that feeling going. And once that feeling of pity, sukha, happiness is going, it's easy to meditate. You are so content, so happy, the mind is inspired and your meditation will go off onto another level. It's called the inspirations. And we use those because the happiness is part and parcel, not only of meditation but also of the Dhamma. Sometimes everybody looks at Buddhism and the first thing they look at, especially, no, not just Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, it's always Four Noble Truths. That's the essence of Buddhism. Even the Buddha said, that's all I teach. That's the essence. And I still remember coming here to Australia the first time and giving my teaching on Four Noble Truths. The Buddha taught about suffering. And people looked at each other and they walked out the room. I thought, what are you doing that for? And I said, look, we know enough about suffering in life. We didn't come here to learn about suffering. That's what we know. We want to find out how to get rid of it. Have some happiness. But you know, in marketing, the first message you put out is the one which people remember the most. And so after a while, you know, you innovate. And starting off with suffering was obviously the psychologically the wrong place to start. So starting off with happiness. And a few people have criticized me for that. Look, you shouldn't mess around with the Buddha's Four Noble Truths. And I argue with them. I'm not messing around with them. Because this is actually what the Buddha was teaching, how to overcome suffering, how to let go of the suffering, how to feel peace, happiness, and freedom, and joy. So it's the third Noble Truth. They're just reordering them, not changing them. And you can see how successful that is. And it's not just successful, it makes a lot of sense and it's actually part and parcel of the Buddha's teachings. It felt right, and then you went to the books and checked it, and actually it was right. So we're emphasizing real happiness. Not an escape from suffering, which is very negative, but an appreciation of real happiness.
and becoming really happy. So it's a path of happiness. You mention that, you emphasize that, because again, that changes a lot about the way you run a meditation retreat. If this was understanding suffering, yes, then I will ring the bell at 4 o'clock. And I'd ring it loudly. I'd have little speakers in each one of your rooms, amplified, so you could not miss the bell. And it would be ringing for 5 or 10 minutes. And if you hadn't come out of your room by 10 minutes, we would send these big, we'd get some few friends from up the prison over there, some of these psychotic serial killers, to go to your room and explain the importance of coming to the room at 4:15. You wouldn't have coffee in the morning or be able to go. That would be locked. No breakfast, bread and water. Real meditators. No cushions, no chairs. If you want to know suffering, yeah, we can teach you suffering. But does that really get you anywhere? And I think you've known the way that we run the retreat here, it's not just indulging you. There's a reason behind this. Teaching you happiness. That's all the Buddha taught. Happiness and the end of suffering. So don't worry about meditation, whether you've got jhanas yet. Have you attained happiness? And how much? Have you received the first level of happiness, the second level of happiness, the third level of happiness? Don't say that's the first level of enlightenment. Second level, third level. See the levels of happiness. How happy are you here? And that's why you will find every time you try and get something, do something, achieve something, that's the cause of your suffering, isn't it? I don't know, you may have already got second jhana and you're just so unhappy because you can't get third jhana. Oh, it really sucks. I've really been working hard. I can only get second jhana. I can't get third. Oh, it's a waste of time. This is a bad retreat. Some of you will be happy if you get to half jhana. And there's someone worrying about can't get to third. But actually what's happened? It doesn't matter what you've got. It's what you want is the cause of suffering. You can be a multi-billionaire and still want more. That is why you suffer. You can be just a poor peasant who's got just enough food for the next day and be totally happy. And that's amazing. I've seen that so many times. That was one of the first things which I noticed going to the northeast Thailand. Dirt poor village. And that's all they had, just rice and a few rotten fish, you know, for the meal. My goodness, they were far, far happier. Now this will shock me, because you know, I went to Cambridge, okay, and in that there was one guy I knew was an earl, the other one was incredibly multi-rich families or whatever, because all those snobby people, I wasn't snob, I came from a council house in West London. My father was very, he was dead by that time. So I was really poor, but all these other people were filthy rich. And so I knew what it was like to be with the filthy rich. Now the master of the cottage was a Nobel Prize winner, so you had dinner with him. And I never saw such happy people as these dirt poor villagers who'd only got fourth grade, and that was it. And they were really happy. And that really shocked me. Because I thought you had to be smart and get good degrees to be happy. That's what people told me. Get your degree and then you'll be happy. I thought, you know, I worked so hard for that and they deceived me. I thought you had to be rich to be happy. Because that's why people work so hard. You work so hard. You work hard to get your promotions and you save money and you really invest it because you try and get to be rich. And these people never had anything and they were much happier than any multi-billionaire that I knew. That really sort of shook me. But you know, in that village, not everyone was happy. Because there I saw one person. They were the upwardly mobile. They had one water buffalo, and they were working hard and saving up for the second water buffalo. They were the ones who were poor. They were exactly the same as the person who had 1 million and were trying to get their second million. They were not content. And that was very, very clear to me that the contentment, that was a cause of happiness. Yeah, they worked, you know, sometimes, but they knew how to enjoy themselves when there was no work to do. As I said earlier, when you want more, even good things, you can't enjoy what you already have. So look, what have you got here? You've got this beautiful place. Reasonably healthy body. Yeah, it may not be the best. It may be sick and sore, but at least you're not dying of cancer in the hospice ward with all these tubes out of you. Look what you have. This is good enough. Yeah, you may not be enlightened yet. Your meditation may be way down the bottom, but look, you're good enough. It's good enough, okay? Enjoy the day. Go for the path of happiness, of letting go. Not indulging, but letting go. The beautiful of peace, of giving. And if your meditation's not good, just go in there, even though it's not your turn, and wash up. Let there be a fight in the kitchen of who has a chance to mop the floor. Instead of, I did it yesterday, it's your turn today. No, I did it the day before, it's your turn, you do it. I'm going off to meditate. I don't want to wash the floor. I didn't come here to wash the floor, I came here to meditate. No, you came here to let go. To help, to be happy. And you find that it makes you happy. So you're learning the joy of happiness, or the way of happiness. And how does that fit into all these jhanas business? Mentioned already. From piti sukha, from joy and happiness, you see the mind becomes still. Sukhino jitang samadhiyati. I don't think I mentioned that. I mention that in the monastery every other week. Sukhino jitang samadhiyati. From happiness, the mind becomes still. Saying of the Buddha. Not once, maybe 50, 60, 70 times, maybe more than that, throughout the suttas. It's a great law. From happiness, the mind becomes still and gets into deep meditation. Not from suffering, not from irritation, not from, but from, ooh. So you inspire yourself, and it's so easy to meditate. You try that out. A great talk, you see an inspiring action, or you just remember something beautiful which you've done, and you sit there, I'm peaceful, I'm still. The mind is not wandering. The mind doesn't think because it's full, it's content, it's satisfied. It doesn't have to, it's just like when you've had enough to eat. Your tummy is satisfied. You don't even think of food. You know, when you've had enough. So when you've had enough happiness there, you don't even think of sexual fantasies or plans or memories. You don't need anything. You're just satisfied. You're content. So that inspiration gives that contentment, which gives the stillness. And that's what I call the snowball effect. There comes a time when that happiness just feeds on itself and just gets stronger and stronger and stronger. That's a nice part of Buddhism. And sometimes even, I read widely, even Pope John Paul, he called Buddhism auto-eroticism. Really a weird word. Eroticism, that's concerned with the five senses. It's close, it's joy and bliss, and it's, you know, not really auto, it doesn't come from yourself, it's automatic bliss, yes. But, you know, he missed the point there, because he didn't have any understanding about the bliss of the mind. But this is what happens, the inspiration comes up, and it's much better than eroticism. You know, it's I don't know what you call it, the bliss of the mind, not concerned with anything to do with attaining things or getting things, and it just grows and grows and gets incredibly strong. That is the path. Sometimes, that's what I call it, bliss upon bliss upon bliss. You get to the stage of just the delightful breath, and when the breath disappears, you go to the next stage of pleasure, the beautiful nimitta. Well, that's really nice. When that disappears and settles down, it becomes so still, it vanishes. You get to the next stage of the first jhana, that's even more bliss. The second jhana is even more bliss than the bliss before. The objects of the jhana, what you're actually watching, it's not the breath, it's not the body. The objects of your mind in jhana are bliss. But all the different flavors of bliss. flavors of bliss which you've never experienced before. You never thought that such bliss could exist. Bliss upon bliss upon bliss. Happiness upon happiness. That is the path of meditation and Buddhism. That makes it incredibly attractive when you put it that way. It's not eradicating suffering. Yeah, it is, but we don't focus on that part of it. We focus on this beautiful feeling which you know in your heart whenever you keep ethics, just growing and growing to this beautiful feeling of the deep meditations. Powerful. Immense. And of course, you can't think your way in. This is a feeling, it's inspirational. Just the same way that you can never sort of write down and describe the feelings of, you know, when you see someone do a beautiful act of sacrifice and generosity, and your eyes get all moist. I can't put words into those feelings. Maybe poets can, but I'm not a poet. Describing those incredibly beautiful emotions, this is what I'm talking about. It gets more and more and more. You multiply that by a million, and you know what it's like to be in jhana. So sometimes, yesterday people asked me, what is a jhana factor? Can you describe second jhana? What I described was just the thoughts about the jhana. That's the theories. They experience incredible happiness. I said better than sex before, but you know, sex is a different type of pleasure altogether. You know, the inspirational pleasures, that gives you an idea of what the jhanas are. Inspiring, uplifting, ooh, beyond words. So if that is the jhanas and that leads to the highest happiness of all, nirvana, then you know the path. Not to think your way in, but to feel your way in. It's an emotional journey, not an intellectual journey. Which is why I'm going to say something controversial now, but I've already said this before. Women have a much easier time getting into jhana than men, generally speaking. There are exceptions, but usually the girls have a faster chance. And all the girls are thinking, woo, yay! And all the men are thinking, that sucks, that's unfair. That's what I found just by experience. I think, why is that? And it is because many men are sometimes afraid. They don't know how to deal with these emotions. And when it gets really strong, out of control emotion, you just don't know what to do with it. So you interfere with it, intellectualize. Most of the philosophers are men. But someone's going to tell me off about this in question time for sure, but never mind. What happens next, though, that, yeah, you get into the jhanas easier. But the men catch you up because they can understand what it means much faster than you. You have many, many jhanas before you come enlightened. They get one or two and they get there straight away. So it becomes fair in the end, it's not much. But the point is, you have to have this ability to feel, to allow those emotions which are totally out of control. This emotional bliss, you can't control it. You just let it go, let it explode. Don't be afraid. And so having that emotional intelligence, the ability to feel, not to try and capture those. Intelligence not means intellectualizing about your emotions, be able to feel them, know they're safe, encourage them, especially the beautiful ones, and let them mushroom until they become so strong that they are the jhanas. Everything disappears, your body disappears, your whole world disappears into bliss. Just emotional joy. Oh, sukhang. This is so nice. Don't be afraid. That's what's supposed to happen. I've emphasized that point because some people still think, and I sometimes despair. If anything makes me angry, this does. When monks say, don't be happy, you'll get attached to it. Oh God, that's really wrong. This is what the path is supposed to be. Don't get attached to the worldly happinesses, but please get attached to the emotional, delightful happinesses. What you're supposed to do.
If you really want to check me out, Arana Vibhanga Sutta is the best there, where it says, monks, you should distinguish between the two types of happiness. One you shouldn't follow. That's the Amisa Sukha, the worldly happiness. The other one you must follow, you should follow. What does it say in Pali? He said, not bayitabang, ase witabang, bawetabang, bahurikatabang. This is not just in one sutta, but many suttas, but it's very clear, maybe the clearest in the Arana Vibhanga Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. And what that means, these happinesses should not be feared. They should not be feared. They should not be feared. They should be followed. Not abandoned, not sort of avoided. They should be followed, developed, and made much of. And that was intuitive. I knew that that was right, because that's actually what I've been doing intuitively for so many years. And it was so nice to have a saying of the Buddha you could quote, which made it so absolutely clear that happiness is in meditation. Should not be feared. When they come up, well done. Not to fear them, but to celebrate them. Not to sort of destroy them, but follow them. Indulge in them. Make much of them. Develop them. Let them grow stronger. That is the path of meditation, according to the Buddha. That is the path to Nibbana, according to the Buddha. Check it out. That's what it says. So, at last, I'm allowed to be happy. I can meditate and be happy. I can be in this retreat and be happy, and I'm not doing anything wrong. Because every time I was happy before, people told me I was doing something wrong. And now I can be happy, and the teacher's telling me I'm doing something right. I can be happy without guilt. Oh, what a relief that is. Because mostly in the world, to be happy you have to be naughty and do wrong things. Go to the casino, go to the pub, or go and have sex with somebody. But this is happiness which is virtuous, beautiful, pure, wonderful. And it gets more and more and more. You're just on the path. Buddha air has taken off. Where is it going? To more and more happiness. You ain't seen nothing yet. It's going to get better and better. Oh, better. Oh, yeah. That's what it's like. So isn't that a nice path? It's not a path. You're going to go to hell, you sinners. You evil ones. You're a girl. You know, you're a sinner. You know, you're a gay. You're going to burn. You say, no, you're all loved. You're all going to have beautiful, peaceful joy and bliss. And, oh, this is very nice. So that is what you develop. So if you see any sadness, any misery, any frustration, any guilt, any anger, then you've lost the path. Instead, let that go and develop the happiness. If you find that you're back to square one, get to the nearest bathroom. That's why we put two bathrooms just outside here. They're not for going to the toilet. They're going there because they've got mirrors in them. Look at the mirror and smile at yourself. And laugh at yourself. It's a happiness room. If you can't smile at yourself, the two fingers and push up. And get some happiness generated. Go and listen, look at the birds. Look at the chickens. Are they still alive? Yeah, they're still alive there. Get some happiness coming in. In the happiness you get so much joy. And that is where the meditation will take off. So meditation, nirvana, is the path of happiness upon happiness upon happiness. The more suffering you let go of, the more happiness you feel. So yeah, it's a way of overcoming suffering. We know it by how much happiness there is. If someone comes and says, yeah, I've overcome all suffering. Yeah, I'm enlightened. I've come off it. If you've overcome suffering, you have happiness. If there's no dark, there's light. If
it's not cold, it's warm. So see if you can find that beautiful happiness. This is just so nice. When it comes, don't throw it away. Don't think something has gone wrong. Get right in there and develop it further. And then you'll have the beautiful meditations. This is good enough. What more do I want? If I want more, I can't enjoy. I can't have happiness. That is the reason. You want more? Why do you want more anyway? I don't know, because sometimes we thought we're supposed to get more. Someone has sort of brainwashed into going further. Someone has told us if we sit still, something will go wrong. Well, actually, I remember that's a saying in Christianity. The devil makes work for idle hands. Do you remember that simile? That is so wrong. If you have idle hands, you have happiness, you become an angel. So see if you can be, sit here totally idle. Not even thinking, but just blissing out, inspiring. That is the path towards enlightenment. So that's the talk today. It's so easy, isn't it? So just, I'll expect you by lunchtime to all of you be enlightened. Okay, so have a happy time. If you don't enlighten, don't worry about it. Just be happy instead. Okay.